morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Happy Hiroshima Day 75. I start today's program with a poem by former Astorian K. Hilgenberg, Paper Cranes. Radiated into the consciousness of thousands, August 6th will be remembered. The atomic agony of Hiroshima, staged in silent stillness of burned flesh and radiation, puking and hairless nakedness. The incredible heat that burned friends into concrete walls, also photographed shirts onto backs, chests, and stomachs. In quiet hunger and thirst, the desperate survivors could not count their dead. And yes, there were no apologies. The United States sent scientists, engineers, to assess and measure the damage. American grandchildren have not forgotten that our government ended the war and saved thousands of lives. In our inherited guilt, we, too, have seen the arbitrary callousness. And our Japanese brothers cannot forget their opportunity for firsthand observation, the chance to study the atomic particle as it eats still insidiously into the bones and skin and hearts of the survivors as they fold paper cranes. And that was Kay Hilgenberg, her poem, Paper Cranes. These, we learn, are the facts of the matter, Kai Erickson, editor of the Yale Review, wrote. A single B-29, lazy in the morning sky, passes over the center of Hiroshima at an elevation of 25,000 feet without attracting much attention. A few seconds later, the whole area is lit up with a bluish-white glare, which is quickly transformed into a huge fireball and a thick column of smoke beginning its climb into the sky. Heat rays from the initial flash blister roof tiles for a distance of several hundred yards, char telephone poles more than a mile away, and burn exposed human flesh as far away as 2.5 miles. The heat rays are followed in an instant by a seemingly soundless blast wave that smashes everything standing for a considerable distance and fills the air with bits of debris. A period of relative calm follows as the day darkens under clouds of dust raised by the blast. And then a conflagration, a virtual whirlwind of fire, bursts into motion and rages out of control for the rest of the morning and afternoon. In the meantime, minute particles of carbon, as well as fission fragments and other debris, are sucked into the colder air overhead, where they condense and return in the form of an oily black rain, slick and full of radioactive fallout. In a matter of hours, 9 square miles of 400-year-old Hiroshima are reduced to dust and ashes. And that was by Kai Erickson. 3 days later, on August 9th, 1945, another B-29 dropped an atomic bomb on the Japanese city of Nagasaki, site of Puccini's famous opera, Madame Butterfly, who commits suicide over a faithless American lover one fine day, nearly half a century earlier. As many as 140,000 people in Hiroshima and 70,000 in Nagasaki died on the days mushroom clouds suddenly appeared over their cities or in the immediate weeks afterward. Hundreds of thousands more were severely injured, never to recover. Radiation sickened and killed nearly all of them, as well as thousands more who were not injured by the initial blast. The world's most experienced experts on the consequences of nuclear weapons are the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, truly the first real citizens of the nuclear age, along with World War II Holocaust survivors. Those who remain alive 75 years later are relics of what is considered one of the greatest horrors humanity has yet imposed on itself. And that's a quote. The enemy has begun to use a new and most cruel bomb, Japanese Emperor Hirohito spoke over radio for the first time to the Japanese people on August 15, 1945. Should we continue to fight, it will not only result in the ultimate collapse and obliteration of the Japanese people, but also the total destruction of human civilization. We must, therefore, endure the unendurable. And that was Emperor Hirohito. The development and use of atomic bombs on Japan will be disputed for perhaps as long as there is a human future. The advent of the nuclear age might always be a topic of debate, although a millennium from now, if civilization survives that long, the beginning of atomic power will be as misty as the discovery of fire or the first use of a hammer. Two such useful essentials, no one can conceive that humanity ever functioned without them, which future generations might think about splitting the atom, presuming humanity does not extinct itself by such agency. The two nuclear bombs that ended World War II have since been a tantalizing disappointment that war might have been jettisoned as a suicidal futility. Instead, a so-called Cold War that consisted primarily of a reckless nuclear arms race, punctuated with brushfire wars among satellite nations, which acted as pressure valves even as they skirted nuclear oblivion. The result was a shaky, shifting balance of terror as the two reigning superpowers, the USA and USSR, spent astronomical amounts of money and resources developing multifarious generations of nuclear arsenals, each posing the threat of the other to perpetually escalate and accelerate mutual suicide toward midnight across the face of a doomsday clock. It was estimated that the USA and USSR met in mutual disarmament conferences several thousand times during the half-century Cold War, but not a single nuclear weapon or warhead was removed from either arsenal. On the contrary, the nuclear arms race had escalated relentlessly with the superpowers in combined possession of firepower in excess of about 2 million times all the bombs, bullets, and artillery used in World War II. Within four decades, the USA and USSR built up arsenals, which together contain more than 60,000 nuclear warheads. The Soviet Union's nukes alone numbered some 45,000 at their peak in 1986. The USSR has enough multi-megaton nuclear warheads to bomb the USA every hour, every day, for a year, or 175 bombs in each state, and use less than half its supply, Shea Williams and Jim Weathers of Cannon Beach wrote in a statement that accompanied their 1983 poster design, Save the Human Being. The USA could bomb the USSR with half our supply for almost 2 years, they wrote, and asked, why have we allowed our governments to build over 50,000 nuclear warheads? The obsessive secrecy of the nuclear powers throughout the Cold War effectively removed the public from the issue and made it a process of a very few on either side of the Iron Curtain. A nuclear priesthood developed among each of the belligerents, a small insular group of scientists, political and military leaders, and influential nuclear munitions manufacturers making drastically dangerous decisions and diabolically concealing them from the general publics of either adversarial regime. From the very beginning, Americans and Russian citizenries were opted out of the most critical issues of the nuclear age. Surrendering their right to know about nuclear policies certainly contributed to ordinary Americans' alienation from political policies and processes in general. As one critical pundit questioned, to what extent do we feel ourselves a people who have been unforgivably deceived in the most fundamental of human areas, having to do with how, when, and by whose hand or lethal technology are we to die for? Consequentially, Americans have been reluctant to teach their children about nuclear war, while ever more grotesque weapons were rapidly being developed, generations of deadly weaponry speeding past human generational succession. Although children while at school conducted quite useless duck and cover drills from the advent of the Cold War, they were essentially left clueless as to why. Oregon attempted to establish a curriculum in public schools, both elementary and high school, to teach about nuclear war. The idea was to develop a program of the history of the nuclear age and the arms race that so quickly developed, the consequence of the use of nuclear weapons and the alternate forms of resolving conflict short of war, nuclear or not. The issue caused intense and heated debate. Supporters, mostly Democrats, said teaching children about nuclear war might be an important step toward averting Holocaust. Opponents, mostly Republicans, said it would create fear in children and weaken the nation's resolve to defend itself. Essentially, the people who didn't want kids to know about nuclear war were those whose policies endorsed and encouraged it. One state representative of the legislature, a Republican, compared nuclear education to sex education, which he said produced more pregnancies, abortions, and homosexuals than before it was taught. A 10-year-old girl wrote in a letter to an Oregon newspaper after watching a movie about nuclear war that she was afraid for her future. "I don't want war to happen," she wrote. "If a bomb does explode, I think I would rather die than live. Now when I think of my future, I think of nothing. I hope a war will never happen." A Seaside, Oregon woman, Carol Spangler, wrote a letter to her town council at the height of the Cold War, which was also an open letter to the world. "I am begging and pleading that this nuclear insanity be stopped now, before it is too late. Never before have I had such fears for the future." She wrote that her 12-year-old daughter listens with terror to the news reports. She reads with horror the news headlines. "She asks me, why is this happening? I want to live. I want to grow up and have children of my own and to watch them grow." Carol Spangler owned a motel and before that a small farm. "The terrible loss of the future," she expressed in her letter, "might well have been a gestalt that ultimately moved millions of recently silent Americans to openly protest the nuclear arms race after nearly a generation since Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I am asking every man, woman, and child, every township, state government, every church, to formally protest and demand an immediate disarmament for now and ever," Carol Spangler wrote. "Let us live in peace and with the knowledge that we have a future." She was rebuffed by Seaside City Council, but her letter and consequent actions against nuclear blackmail garnered her many supporters who started a petition that quickly received nearly 1,000 signatures. Anti-nuke groups such as North Coast Oregon CALS, Citizen Action for Lasting Security, formed all over the USA, Western Europe, and certainly Japan, in which Hiroshima Day was conceived and commemorated all over the world every August 6th. Ultimately, the superpowers' nuclear posturing underestimated the anger and disappointment felt by much of the world's human population. The growing anger and fear of nuclear obliteration was especially fueled by U.S. President Ronald Reagan's mortgaging the U.S. economy to break the USSR in an all-out arms race. And though the Russians cracked first, the USA was also seriously crippled. By then, some very disturbed nations either possessed or were coming online with nuclear weapons. And like North Korea today, seemed little concerned about using them. Hundreds of millions of people all over Earth who were forced to pinch their own lives to pay in one way or another for rampant nuclear terror put pressure on their own governments and the United Nations. In 1978, the UN responded for the first time in a special session on disarmament and called on nuclear nations to eliminate nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons pose the greatest danger to mankind and the survival of civilization, the UN mandate declared. The most effective guarantee against the danger of nuclear war and the use of nuclear weapons is nuclear disarmament and the complete elimination of nuclear weapons. Quote, unquote. The USSR imploded in the late 1980s, and the USA became the remaining superpower. For a few decades after the end of the Cold War, measures were taken to dismantle the immense nuclear stockpiles of the USA and former USSR. The USA has made its own slide toward implosion, with considerable covert assistance by Russia's non-democratic successor to its failed Red Star communist state, and certainly by ambitious domestic quislings. It would seem now, two decades into a new millennium, that the two former major empires are rattling around in mutual graveyards of petty dictatorships that desire to reignite the nuclear arms race all over again by dissolving all the preventive barriers that eliminated it the first time. And that was something I wrote. And I would like to conclude it with a poem. I Would Be a Witness for Hiroshima by Sadako Kurihara. It was August 6th in 1945, at an early hour of the day. Men and women were to start their daily work when unexpectedly the city and all were blown away, blistered hideously, each and all. The seven rivers were filled with naked corpses. I wish as a survivor to be a real human being. Besides, as a poor mother, fearing a day when the blue sky above the red-cheeked children and those thousands with promising futures may be smashed to atoms all of a sudden, endangering their bright futures, and now to be repeated at the nation's cost. I resolve to shed tears supposedly to be shed on dead bodies, afresh for those people living now, declaring against all war, first of all. Even if I should perchance be punished under a disgraceful name, from a mother's protest against death for her own son's sake, I should never dare to hide myself, never, because the day was too much impressed on my retina, the hellish day of that fatal blaze. Supposing there is a tale of the inferno, which a man caught a glimpse of once, and happens to warn me of its horror, to be called back by the Lord of the Inferno, the moment he tells it to someone else, I would go wherever it is, as a witness of the Hiroshima tragedy, that I might proclaim its misery. I would sing for my life, no more wars on the earth. And that was Sadako Kurihara. I Would Be a Witness for Hiroshima. And now, by David Horowitz. City of Roses, Colored Glasses. As activists across the country seek to emulate Portland, Oregon's two-month-old standoff with local police and federal agents, it is important to note that the picture is far more complex than the progressive narrative suggests. The consequences for the movement for racial justice and other progressive concerns may be quite severe. On the very first evening of demonstrations following the George Floyd killing, a small group of mostly white young men trashed and set fire to Portland's downtown Justice Center as civilian employees worked inside. They also damaged and looted businesses down the street. Some, like a pawn shop and a subway outlet, have decided not to return. Every succeeding night, small contingents waited until most peaceful demonstrators had left, and then attacked the police protecting the center with fireworks, frozen water bottles, assorted pieces of debris, and laser beams directed at officers' eyes. A few weeks later, a group marched through northeast Portland, tagging empty walls and sidewalks with graffiti like, "F the police." Upon reaching the North Precinct headquarters, they set fire to the station, again with people inside, and trashed adjoining businesses. Community leaders and local clergy joined the mayor in a press conference the next day to denounce the vandalism. Their anger stemmed from the fact that the African-American community had worked for years to invite investment in the neighborhood, and that the police station was supposed to be an anchor for independently owned black businesses. An African-American minister said, "Hell wasn't good enough for the people who trashed the stores." A black woman business operator said she suspected that none of the vandals looked like her. Not long after, activists tried to burn down the police union building. As the demonstrations continued at the fence protesting the Justice Center, an African-American police officer with a history degree from Portland State University told an interviewer that on several occasions he had engaged individual protesters in civil exchanges, only to have young white men literally drag these people away from the conversation. In reality, the Portland Bureau has undertaken efforts to address current demands for a transformation of the department. In June, the white female chief resigned to make way for an African-American from the ranks committed to police reform. Under his leadership, the Bureau is reallocating some resources, increasing the use of non-uniformed personnel, and placing restrictions on tear gas deployment. Like it or not, they will be stakeholders in negotiations over further reforms. The Portland Police has also declined to cooperate with federal agents. When the Justice Center protests began to wane, a small group moved on to the federal building. This was presumably a continuation of last year's demonstrations to abolish ICE, quote unquote, an arbitrary demand when large numbers of Americans want some control of the border, though obviously on far more humane terms than at present. When fires and other attacks on the building ensued, President Trump had his opportunity to send in federal agents. By inciting an unruly contest of wills between protesters and unidentified government forces, the White House had the perfect scenario for a campaign appeal to law and order, quote unquote. In response, Portland's wall of moms sought to protect the majority of peaceful demonstrators from the feds, while discouraging hooliganism from a minority of activists. Yet after midnight, the violence resumed, thereby inviting an inevitable tit-for-tat response from authorities. The damage to both the inside and exterior of the federal courthouse in Portland is not as catastrophic as Fox News might allege, but more seriously than the minor acts of resistance, quote-unquote, some supporters claim. The toll also includes 24 injuries to federal agents, some of them serious, another pretext for responses from the force. As Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf has pointed out, images of a vandalized downtown play right into Donald Trump's twisted campaign strategy and justify the dispatch of federal troops to incite more unrest. There is already evidence from CNN that voters in Florida see the president as more likely than Joe Biden, 51% to 46%, to keep Americans, quote, safe from harm. A greater danger lies with Senate races in red states, where a slight loss of independent and moderates could cost Democrats the needed pickups to recapture the majority. Perhaps the most lasting consequence of the disturbances lies with the potential erosion of public trust in social movements of all kinds and distraction of public attention from the pressing issues of racial injustice that inspired the protests to begin with. The point was graphically made in a recent Washington Post op-ed by Portland NAACP President E.D. Mondane, who called out the self-indulgent spectacle unleashed by anarchist elements with their own agendas. Rather than engaging in what Mondaine described as empty battles, where Trump and his allies have the advantage, participants in social movements will have to learn to subject personal desires and impulses to the good of the whole. Politics is about disciplined communication, not self-expression or even individual rights. The first rule of effective communication is to sense how a message will be received. It is frustrating that despite the unspeakable toll of death and suffering associated with government mismanagement of the current pandemic, long-term prospects for changes look hopeful. But if progressives are to contribute to the moment that arguably will emerge in 2021, they will need to be disciplined with eyes focused on the prize. That means engagement in discourse that helps to rebuild the social fabric of the nation while addressing its profound challenges. That project has no room for the destructive impulses of people who feel compelled to strike against authority in principle. As John Lennon proposed, we must do the best we can to make it better, as Paul McCartney once pleaded. Though many of us from the generation of Vietnam War protest may have unfinished business on our plate, we must be careful about projecting our aspirations on successors who may be as susceptible to the same challenges and pitfalls we faced. There are no messiahs in living history. The arc of justice may lean toward righteousness or not, but in any case, it usually takes a long time to get there. Advocates for social change cannot afford to sport City of Roses colored glasses. And that was City of Roses Colored Glasses by David Horowitz, who is a history professor emeritus at Portland State University and author of America's Political Class Under Fire, The 20th Century's Great Culture War. And his birthday is coming up August 17th. He will be 79, 2 days before I turn the same age. He's been a longtime friend. This is Michael McCusker. On this 75th Hiroshima Day, it might be a good idea to think about the consequences of mass horror, whether from re-emerging nuclear terror or of pandemics that kill hundreds of thousands and literally sicken many thousands of others for years or for the rest of their lives. Stay safe. Practice safe masking. Remember, protecting yourself protects everybody else. Happy Hiroshima Day.